From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
I'm here with my Carnegie colleague, Dmitry Trenin, the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, who is in Beijing this week for the third annual Carnegie Global Dialogue here in Beijing, China. Listeners will remember Dmitry as this is his third time on the Carnegie Tsinghua podcast. That's a record, by the way.
Oh, good.
I spoke with him by phone to understand the Russian perspective on the Ukraine crisis. That was back in March 2014. And then also at the old Carnegie Tsinghua Center office here in May of 2015, you and I talked about China-Russian relations after the Ukraine crisis. So welcome back.
Well, thank you. Glad to be on the program.
Dmitry, yesterday we had a roundtable at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center with Chinese experts on Russia. And you made the case that China's westward march across Eurasia is reshaping Eurasia and other parts of the globe. Can we start by just, when I ask you if you can explain how so? How do you see that happening and what are the consequences both for the region and for Russia?
Well, if you look at Eurasia as this grand continent stretching all the way from East Asia to the British Isles, you will see that the dynamic in the last 800 years for integrating that continent usually came from the West. It usually was pioneered by this or that European nation. Well, it was not the case 800 years ago when the Mongols integrated Eurasia coming from the East. Well, we see a very different phenomenon now, but a phenomenon centered in East Asia. You see China through its economic expansion moving more and more westward. And now with the One Belt, One Road program initiative, no matter how you call it, this has become more structured. And this has become more purpose-orientated. And I see this as transformative also in terms of China's own foreign policy. Prior to this, China's foreign policy was largely about economic issues. But now, I would make the case, this westward march is more than geoeconomics. It brings in tow geopolitics. It brings a strategic dimension to China's foreign policy, which was not there before and which I don't think is there yet. Mm-hmm. But that's the way we're going. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is tremendously important for the future of China's neighbors, for the future of the countries who think of China as a distant country, say, you look at China from London or from Paris or Berlin, it's way, way out there. But China is coming to Europe, whereas Europe in the past used to come to China.
So we're looking, obviously, at a more active and a stronger China, both in terms of, as you say, geoeconomic power, but also geopolitical, certainly in the future. And yesterday you said that China-Russia relations have also undergone a change in the nature and stature in terms of the power balance and have reached what you called a new normal. Can you explain that?
Well, the China-Russia relationship got normalized at the end of the Cold War. In fact, the Soviet Union and China were engaged in a Cold War of their own. Since then, the relationship has been friendly, good neighborly, based increasingly on partnership. But again, I would say two things. One, the quality of the relationship has changed And it's more than partnership. It's less than an alliance, but clearly more than partnership. And I call this entente, for lack of a better word. I don't think it will evolve into a partnership, but it's much closer than it was even a couple of years ago. Also as a result of Russia's rupture with the West and Russia's separation from Europe or alienation from Europe, which is of monumental importance to Russia's foreign policy. And I would add also that for the first time in 200 plus years since China and Russia first came into direct contact, the relationship is tilted in China's favor. The balance within the relationship, if you like, the structure of the relationship has changed and keeps changing. China is more and more the senior partner or the bigger power in that relationship. And this carries very serious implications. First of all, the Russians need to learn to live and cooperate with a strong China and an active China. And second of all, it will be difficult for the Russians and yet essential to them to structure the relationship in such a way that China does not become Russia's overlord. Russia cannot accept anyone above them. He's just physically, mentally, they cannot accept someone sitting on top of them. And China is bigger, and yet how you square the circle, how you structure a co-equal relationship between unequal partners, mm-hmm. and that's Russia's mm-hmm. task.
So you talk a lot about the Chinese factors that are changing and how that's affecting Eurasia, but also China-Russia relations. What are the Russian considerations with respect to China? And why then do you argue, as China expands westward, Russia is integrating more eastward?
Well, Russia's, as China is moving westward, Russia is looking more toward the east. There are two reasons for that. One reason is essentially geoeconomic, geopolitical, and that is mostly focused on Russia's own eastern or Asian territories. All the way east of the Urals. You have a situation untenable in the long term where Russia's most depressed regions are either far east, are physically in contact with touching physically on the world's most dynamic region, i.e. China. So you need to do something about that. That's one thing. The other thing is that after the Ukraine crisis, China has remained the only major power that still has normal relations with Russia. Relationships with the United States, Europe, Japan, other countries, Canada, Australia, have all been damaged or broken as a result of the Ukraine crisis. China stands out, so there's a compelling reason for the Russians to reach out to China and to try to get the things that the Russians, such as technology investment and others, that they used to get from the West but cannot get from the West now, or they want to try to get that from China.
So do you see a shift basically in the overall foreign policy concept in Russia, where previously, there was a real emphasis on wanting to integrate with Europe, and is there now a greater focus on Asia?
I think so. This is more out of necessity than out mm-hmm. of choice. Mm-hmm. Russia has had two foreign policy concepts, one integrating itself into the West, and the alternative to that during the past 25 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union has been integrating former Soviet republics or former Soviet borderlands with Russia or into Russia. Now, both of those concepts are inoperable mm-hmm. right now as a result of the Ukraine crisis. So you may say they both crashed in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So they need to find a way to both position themselves in this new world given the current relationships, which will be there for some time with the West, with the neighbors, and to find the right position vis-a-vis China. If you like, there was a plan A that failed, a plan B that failed. Now they have to come up with plan C. Now, plan C cannot be China, cannot be about China only. But China will have to play a major role in all that. But early Russian illusions about China substituting for the United States and Europe in Russia's foreign policy and Russia's geoeconomic strategy, they have been very quickly revealed as illusionary, and it's a good thing basically that the Russians fairly early on could see that, for example, borrowing a lot of money from China, you cannot do that. Mm-hmm. It's an illusion. You have to think again. Mm-hmm. And this has produced a modicum of realism mm-hmm. in Russia's general approach toward China.
Mm-hmm. And then let me, on the China-Russia relationship, the last piece I want to ask about is the United States. And how does the United States, you've talked about China's evolution and how that's changing the nature of the relationship with Russia. You talk about developments with respect to Russia and how that's affecting it. How does the U.S. figure into this?
Well, the U.S. has been the dominant power in the world and the guarantor of the global order in the post-Cold War period. Now, to a large extent, this continues to this day and will continue as long as I can see. But something has changed. There are two things that have changed. There is a challenge that China presents to this order and to the U.S. dominance. China, through its rise, through its expansion, geoeconomic, potentially geopolitical, it changes the situation in a most serious way. Russia has challenged that order in a different way, in a very in-your-face move, mm-hmm. in a very blatant move in Ukraine, where it defended its national security interest, as the Kremlin formulates it, vis-a-vis what it saw as a U.S. political invasion into the Russian sphere of influence, Russian geopolitical space, whatever. And then they inserted the Russian military into the heart of the Middle East in Syria, and thus they undercut the de facto U.S. monopoly on the use of force globally. And this was another attack, if you like, on the U.S. Dominated, U.S. Supported global order. But if you look at China and Russia, you will see that the trend of the trend where major powers want to be surrounded by, call it spheres of influence, call it spheres of comfort, whatever you want to mm-hmm. call it. Mm-hmm. You look at Ukraine from Moscow, you look at the South China Sea from Beijing, you look at these things and you look at the moves, very different moves by Russia in its neighborhood, by China in its neighborhood, and you will see that both major powers want to expand their wiggle room. Mm-hmm. And this comes naturally at the expense of the order so far dominated and guaranteed by the United States. So you see the global power retrenching a little bit, and the regional, or called the major powers in Eurasia, expanding or seeking to expand their zones of influence. This leads to a major rearrangement of forces in Eurasia and globally. So I think that this leads you to thinking again about a triangular dynamic mm-hmm. among Washington, Beijing, and Moscow, very different from what the situation was during the Cold War. And yet, you still have those three main actors, and possibly in the distant future, also Delhi, coming to compete more and more intensely about the world order and about the geopolitics of this grand region, which is Eurasia.
So, you know, you don't see an overt expression of support from Russia, for example, with respect to China's claims in the South China Sea, or you don't see it the other way from China over Russia's sphere of influence with respect to Ukraine. Is there a sort of a wink, wink, nod, nod? We won't get involved in what sphere of influence you want, and you don't get involved in ours?
Well, I call the relationship an entente, not an alliance, which means that there is no obligatory support that the other party should extend it to your moves wherever. Mm-hmm. So I think the understanding, and that's the essence of this entente, the understanding between China and Russia is that we're not going to form a rigid alliance. There will be no hierarchy in our relationship, which is fine for the Russians. You are not expected to support each and every move that we're making, but we will not be giving support to each and every move that you are making, but there's an understanding that neither side will undercut the other.
Or block or object
in their respective, call it spheres of influence or vitally important issues.
Right, right.
So that's the beauty, I think, of the relationship that makes it, I believe, more stable than an alliance would have been.
Getting closer, but not too close.
Exactly.
So we've been talking about some fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your insights. We'll move away from something so lofty and heady, and I want to ask you about the 2016 presidential campaign, where Russia has featured prominently. But I want to ask you about something that you might not expect.
Okay.
The current front runner on the Republican side, to many people's great surprise, is Donald Trump. He and President Putin have expressed mutual admiration for each other. Putin called Trump a brilliant and talented leader after Trump said that he would probably get along well with Putin. What do you make of this? What do Russians make of this apparent Trump-Putin bromance?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that Russians appreciate Putin for being a straight talker. He doesn't have to look over his shoulder, also because there is no one behind him and no one above him. He can speak his mind freely, and he is the master of his word because he's the master of the country. And I think a lot of Russians have become very tired of the usual talk of Western politicians, which is all about political correctness.
You say Russians are growing
Russians. Tired. Especially when those people, you know, come to them and preach things and say things, which
well, that's
fine.
What many Americans are saying at the same time, too, that they're growing tired of the political correctness of American politics.
Well, I think that the difference between Russian politicians and a lot of Western politicians is that in Russia you tend to err on the side of cynicism. In so many Western countries, you tend to err on the side of hypocrisy. The political system in the West makes you, you know, say politically correct things, which are often hypocritical. In Russia, because the system is not democratic, and if you are exercise an important role in the system, you can say whatever. You often say cynical things, and I think they appreciate Trump for saying things openly and sincerely, right? The second thing that I believe that they appreciate is that Trump is a rare Western politician these days who says anything good about Russia or Putin. And this really stands out. I mean, you cannot simply let it, you know, you cannot ignore it. You have to reciprocate in some way or form.
Right. Well, it's fascinating. We'll see what will happen. It should be a very interesting several months leading up to November. We'll have much more to talk about in that regard and much more to talk about on China-Russia relations. So thank you very much, Dmitry, for coming back. Hope to have you for a fourth time on the Carnegie Tsinghua podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be your guest.
Thank you.